We're here for argument in Delano versus Bush. The petitioner may proceed.
Good morning, Honorable Justices of the Colorado Supreme Court. My name is Drew Wills. I represent and I am the attorney for the petitioners and the plaintiffs below in this case, Alex Delano, Wolfgang Beck, Carlos Perez, Kevin Werner, and Mark Parker. May it please the court and counsel, this is a case about individuals. It's a case about two individuals who conspired to defraud five employees of their lawfully earned wages. The Court of Appeals overturned the judgment in this case, as you know, and caused a petition for writ of certiorari to be sought before you, and which was granted, and that's what brings us here today. Specifically, the Court of Appeals saw fit on their own to introduce the doctrine of intracorporate immunity into a case involving individuals and our own Colorado statute 1321.11.5 subsection 4, which, as you know, invokes joint liability against those who are found to have acted in a conspiracy in committing torts in the state of Colorado.
Counsel, can I stop you there just to clarify?
Yes.
I mean, essentially, this question arises under joint and several liability, correct? There's no conspiracy claim against these defendants?
There is no conspiracy claim. That's correct, Your Honor. And this case arises purely under the statute.
Okay. So the effect of the Court of Appeals opinion then is that there's no joint liability?
Yes.
I mean, there is liability, but it's simply not joint. Is that...
That is correct, Your Honor.
So basically, I guess what's at issue is whether you can hold everyone for the total amount. Is that...
That's
what we're talking about.
That's correct, Your Honor. And there is only one of the defendants, which is before this court and pursued an appeal. The other defendant, who was found guilty of both misrepresentations and conspiracy, did not appeal. So we have just one of those co-defendants before this court today.
But you're trying to preserve your ability to go against both of them for the full amount.
That is correct, Your Honor. Yes. What we're asking here today is that the court look at the intracorporate immunity doctrine and also the Colorado statute on joint liability and make a determination as to whether or not, first, the intracorporate liability doctrine has any place in the application of that statute. And we believe that it does not. And second, if it does, then isn't the intracorporate immunity doctrine an affirmative defense, which is subject to the rules of civil procedure, specifically 8C, wherein it must be pled as an affirmative defense? It was not in this case. It was raised again for the first time by the Court of Appeals on appeal.
Well, let me start again. So how did the Court of Appeals arrive to this? I mean, was it not raised by any party? I mean, are you suggesting we just thought of it and came to an argument with it? I mean, what was the context?
Your Honor, if you look at the record of the Court of Appeals, both sides have completed briefing. And then there was an order from the Court of Appeals asking both sides to provide supplemental briefs on whether and to what extent the intracorporate immunity doctrine applied to this case. That particular issue had not been raised prior to that point in time. It was then briefed by both sides, and the Court of Appeals reached its decision, which was to apply that doctrine to the statute in this case.
At that point, did you argue that it just could not be raised, that it had been waived?
Yes, I believe we did. Your Honor, in addition, we do have the other issue before this court, and that is simply looking at the record and determining whether or not the trial court, in the light most favorable to the trial court, has any basis at all in the record for its ruling that these individuals were acting outside the scope of their authority when they were committing this fraud and misrepresentation against the employees. We believe there's more than ample evidence in the record itself to support the trial court's finding. And there was a specific finding in the record by the trial court that, in fact, before the misrepresentations were made and the damage was done, that the individual that is before you was involved in the misrepresentations because of his involvement back and forth with the other defendant in the operation of the company, that he had to know, and it was not reasonable for him at that time to believe that it was okay for him to make those representations.
Well, isn't the test, though, that they have to act outside the scope of their authority? I mean, can you relate it to doctrine? I understand your argument is that they must have known they were saying something that was incorrect. They were telling the employees there were 6 months of whatever reserves available, and that just was not true. But can you help me understand how that circles back to the actual legal test? How is that acting outside what the corporation would expect them to be doing?
Well, there are two things, and we have to look at what their apparent authority is based on what their position in the corporation is by virtue of just being an officer or an agent of the corporation. But we must look at what factual information exists as to what they were actually doing or expected to do by that corporation. In the history of this case is that the corporation was started, there was a third party that a venture capitalist overseas that invested $500,000. This particular company purchased computer software in order for the development of that software to be achieved. It was already in progress. The prior company had gone out of business. They thought within a very short period of time that software then could come to the point where it could be marketed and sold. And they looked at that as a great opportunity. There were only two individuals in the United States that were ever involved in this corporation that anybody ever saw or really heard of or had any day-to-day involvement. Those were the two defendants in this case. When the case was originally filed, it was filed against the corporation as well as the individuals. The corporation never made an appearance and defaulted. That the case then came to trial some 5 years later. And the case of Leonard versus McMorris was decided after the case was filed, but was dispositive of the earned and unpaid wages individual liability question. So then the case proceeded against the other individuals on direct claims against them. So now we have a situation where we have two individuals acting. We have the question of whether the intracorporate immunity doctrine now, at least, should be applied to the case for their individual actions. We look first to their position in the corporation as an indication. They were both officers. However, we can't stop there. We must look to the facts of the case. And if you look at the record, what you're going to find in there is you're going to find that in October of 1991, the money had run out and an interest payment had become due. One of the individuals, in order to keep some interest in the corporation, not lose it and not default, then made a deal with the venture capitalists to transfer a majority interest of that of the ownership of the company to them. At that point in time, you will see that he took a very ministerial small role, according to his own testimony, in the case. That begins in October. The control of the corporation then is in the venture capitalists.
Mr. Wells?
Yes.
Can I just follow up and ask you to include in your answer what was the personal or non-corporate, assuming everything you say,
yes,
reason or motivation for the basic misrepresentations that were made to your clients?
One was, we believe, to begin with, to try to get the product completed, but also, Your Honor, personal liability.
Could you explain that a little bit? I mean, it seems like if somebody is concerned about the product, that's pretty much a corporate concept, a corporate matter. So you're acting clearly within, for the purposes of the corporation. But what about personal liability? I don't remember you advancing that in your brief. So I know you made the statement, but I don't quite understand it. Tell me.
Your Honor, I believe that there are personal liability issues with regard to the venture capitalists as well as for the ongoing operations with creditors.
Well, what would that, how would that deal with the two, Mr. Bush and Mr. Jeffers? Because they're the ones you're really seeking.
Yes. With regard to Mr. Bush and Mr. Jeffers, after the time when there was this restructuring, we'll refer to it as the restructuring in October, you will see in all of the financials, and that is an exhibit in the notebook which is before the court, that it is Mr. Bush with his entities and or individually funding the ongoing month-to-month obligations of the company, including the wages of the employees. At that point in time...
Can I just hear just a question? Now, is there any finding of fact about that?
Yes. Yes. At that point in time, Your Honor, you will note also that Leonard versus McMorris was still good law, and the individuals were responsible for paying the earned and unpaid wages of the employees in the state of Colorado. That was since after the filing of this case overturned. But more than that, there are the ongoing day-to-day obligations of this company, and there are leases, there is equipment, there is the purchase of products and services out there that we believe required personal guarantees and the personal involvement of the individuals in this case.
Well, but after October, whenever the change occurred in ownership, is that what you're talking about, after October?
At all times during the operation of this company, there were certain creditors, Your Honor, that would not accept just a corporate signature in order to provide services or products. So there are individuals who have signed and are personally responsible.
I guess the other question I have, in the way you're arguing it today, are you abandoning your argument about the Novotny case?
No, not at all, Your Honor. What I was doing first was trying to lay the groundwork and answer the question that I was asked, and that is, we believe that there's really two arguments we bring before you. One is the intracorporate immunity doctrine should not be applied here because these individuals were acting outside the scope of their authority. And that's clear from the record, and it's clear from their own testimony. But back to the Novotny case, which I think is instructive here, we're talking about a conspiracy of individuals, and the danger here is to take individual activity and the group danger, which Novotny refers to, which is the cornerstone of conspiracy, and make those individuals immune simply by incorporating, simply by creating a corporation. So there is a big difference between a single individual, one person, and a corporation, which we all intellectually understand, although it's a legal construct, that there can be no conspiracy between the corporation and that individual because, in essence, they are one person or one thing. And that is the idea upon which the intracorporate immunity doctrine is based. But when we're talking about two individuals and a corporation, then we have to look a little bit closer. And there were no allegations, there was no argument, and the case was not tried on the basis that these individuals were conspiring with the corporation. The case was tried, the evidence was submitted, and the court found that the individuals themselves, those two persons, were the ones that conspired, and that is why the court, then the trial court, imposed joint liability under our statute, which requires two persons to conspire to commit a tortious act.
Can I ask one question there? Was the theory of conspiracy, it seems a little strange because of the lack of concert of action, if I understood that right, could it be fairly said that the theory of conspiracy itself depended on their relationship to each other as officers of the corporation?
It was more than that, Your Honor. That is only the initial part of it. The conspiracy theory, if you read the trial court's order, was about their day-to-day operations and communication. Realizing that the person who is before you on this appeal was the person who had the purse strings, who wrote the checks, and who had to be in constant communication, and the court found he was in constant communication with the individual who was in Colorado, who was running the day-to-day operations. So there is much more than merely their positions in the corporation. There is the ongoing day-to-day operations in the testimony by both of these individuals. And for example, Mr. Bush, who is before this court now, says multiple times, we did this and we did that, referring to himself and Mr. Jeffers, who was here in Colorado. He then makes specific references to his very limited role after October as just the treasurer of the corporation, but we know that he is the one who is providing the funds that are allowing that corporation to continue, and he is the one that is allowing the circumstance of promising the employees, in this case, that there is going to be money to pay their wages and asking them then to continue to work.
Well, there, just in that statement, it seems to me you've phrased what it seems to be. It's a claim for wages. The motivation is to keep the corporation alive and going in the pursuit of its activities. So it just looks a lot like it's not a personal assumption of liability, but people acting in the interest of the corporation's business. So would you help me through that? I don't understand why they become personally liable for wage claims.
Well, what we have to understand if we look at their actions, Your Honor, I believe, is that they have full knowledge of what the financial situation is of that corporation. And in order to apply the intra-corporate immunity doctrine here, we would have to find that they're acting within the scope of authority with this corporation under some specific direction to lie to these employees so that they would keep working. Not making a misinterpretation or misjudging the financial aspects of the corporation, but in fact to make direct fraudulent misstatements so that they would keep working. And the reason we get to that primarily is because Mr. Bush is the one who is supplying the funds for this corporation, this activity, to continue. And if we look at it in that light, Your Honor, that is drastically different from officers trying to keep a corporation alive on a day-to-day basis, making misstatements because they don't know, or miscalculations because they don't calculate properly about the financial circumstances of the corporation. The fact is, this corporation was out of money in October of 1991. Mr. Bush knew it. Mr. Jeffers knew it. After that point in time, Mr. Bush would, on a month-to-month basis, feed money into this account, would write the checks, and there were misrepresentations during that entire time to these employees that funds would be available for a six-month period of time which would meet their needs to pay their wages. And they kept working because of that. This is all the individual.
Well, that sounds like maybe individual liability.
It is. And I don't believe that there's any question that these individuals have individual liability. In the state of Colorado, whether you are an officer of a corporation or an employee or not, you do have direct liability for your actions, for tortious actions. And that is That has been a long, that's the Snowden case, and that's a longstanding principle. What's being put in front of the court now and what's being advanced by the Court of Appeals is that just because we have this corporation now that was in existence, we are going to get immunity for a conspiracy between these individuals. And we just believe that that's not an appropriate thing to do in this case.
Counsel, can I, before you go on to the next point, can I just follow up, though? Just help me understand, I think you've tried to say this, but just in maybe two sentences, how were those misrepresentations benefiting the defendants on a personal basis? That's the part I mean, I know you've been asked several times, but just help me understand, why were they benefiting personally from the misrepresentations, in your view?
Well, number one, Your Honor, Leonard versus McMorris was the law in the state of Colorado at the time. That case said that the individuals in that corporation, that is Mr. Bush and Mr. Jeffers, would be personally responsible for the earned and unpaid wages of their employees. That's the first thing.
Right, but how does making the misrepresentation help them in that regard?
The misrepresentation kept the employees on the job. The employees were concerned about what they saw as indications for the financial insecurity of the company. There were a number of things that were happening in terms of timing, the checks changing in their appearance. There was no longer a payroll company that was doing the checks. They were being done personally by Mr. Bush. There were things that were beginning to give them signs that there were monetary problems with the company and they're getting paid. So they came to these individuals and then asked them, what's going on? What is the financial condition? At that point, the misrepresentations are made. That keeps them working. Back to your question, we have the Leonard versus McMorris liability issue personally with these individuals, and then on top of that, we have all of the other vendors and service providers who have required that these individuals be personally responsible in order for them, for example, in a lease, to provide the lease space. If it's purchasing equipment, we have personal liability for some of those contracts. But beyond that, we have these individuals, I believe, who, particularly Mr. Bush, who are looking out for their own personal interests by continuing, particularly at the end, to pay only those bills where they feel they may have some personal liability. There is a choice in there that we believe is being made, and there are certain assets that are being taken by creditors, things of that nature at the end, which we believe show that Mr. Bush was looking out for himself.
Mr. Wells, how does the situation you describe differ from any dying corporation where you have officers in it?
Well, Your Honor, again, back to the personal liability of Leonard versus McMorris and personal liability of those others out there.
I understand that argument.
But yes, but Your Honor, that's back to the Novotny case, and I believe that you'd asked a question about that before. And I've looked at that, and Your Honor, as you know, in that particular case, the court just said, look, we are not going to allow a number of individuals who are out there committing torts. In that case, it was under a civil rights federal statute. We don't believe that we should allow that to be done and relieve them from conspiracy liability just because there is a corporation.
Well, I could, it's not made, but I can make an argument that the language is very similar in terms of the wording of both statutes. But we're now talking about federal constitutional rights that was part of legislation that was imposed, you know, after the Civil War. And that's a little different than joint and several liability.
Well, the statutes are quite similar, Your Honor.
The wording is similar. I agree with you.
Yes, the wording is
but it's similar. A different topic, so
yeah.
to speak.
But I do think that the Novotny case is the closest thing that we have found in terms of an analysis of individuals who are committing tortious acts who should be held.
Well, can I summarize my understanding of your argument on the statute?
Yes.
That we said in, I guess, footnote 6 of a couple of years ago, that the statute was pretty clear.
Yes.
And that the statute doesn't say anything about intra-corporate immunity. And so, therefore, it's been abolished by statute. Is that basically your argument?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes.
And it's a common law doctrine, which
yes.
has never been officially adopted, and that there's a policy expressed many moons ago in a case that seems contrary to that doctrine.
That's correct, Your Honor. And we would, at this point in time, just reserve the remaining time here to address those issues, which we believe are appropriate and important. Thank you.
Okay, let me ask you this, though. You several times relied on the Court of Appeals opinion on Leonard v. McMorris, but never became final. We took cert and reversed it. I don't get that, actually. Am I forgetting something?
It was just timing, Your Honor. This is one of those...
But it was not, the Court of Appeals decision was not Colorado law. That's what we found in the majority opinion and decision by this court and Leonard v. McMorris, correct?
Yes.
So how does that generate some sort of inferred cause of action for joint and several liability? I'm just not making the connection.
Just Your Honor, that at that point in time, everybody believed that there was, in fact, individual liability that was expressed. That was what everybody believed was the law at that time, Your Honor. So I believe that the individual defendants in this case understood that they might be subject to that. That's the argument. It's just a timing thing, Your Honor. Okay, thank you. Thank you. I'll reserve my remaining time.
I'll return this for counsel when I'm done, but I was told it is my responsibility to get this all hooked up, so bear with me.
Well, thanks for your help.
Defendant's side, Mr. Bush.
Excuse me, just before you get going, could you just state your name?
I'm sorry, my name is James Reed. I'm from Colorado Springs. My registration number is 7796. And with that old registration number, I should have been in front of you guys several times. This is my first time in front of your court, so if I appear nervous, there's an easy answer. I am nervous. Okay. This started as a wage claim act, and I think it's going to remain a wage claim act all the way through. Within just a few weeks of my entrance into the case, I filed a 12B5 motion to dismiss the action because it was just listed as a wage claim. The trial court did that, but indicated that the counsel could amend, for the plaintiffs could amend if he could find some independent reason for the defendants to be held liable. We went through about three generations of complaints, and ultimately, the last one talked about joint and several liability, but there was no separate conspiracy claim. The only reason I mention that is that the case wasn't really tried at the trial court level on a conspiracy doctrine. That's why you're going to find a paucity of evidence at the trial court level of anything involving a conspiracy.
Well,
it's discussed.
Mr. Reed, but looking at the trial court's findings, it sure sounds like a conspiracy. Use that word, so can't we assume that he factually said there was a conspiracy?
What I'm saying is there's no evidence to support it. The evidence that came in the record,
well,
so we didn't talk about conspiracy.
You don't have to. It's just you can imply a conspiracy. A conspiracy is agreement by two people, right?
Well, it's more than just that, but it's...
You have to agree to do an unlawful act.
For purpose of adding to court,
for tortious act.
Yes. The two or more people is the center of the argument here. There was a question about pleadings. whether the defendant should have pled as an affirmative defense the inter-corp conspiracy doctrine, and I would suggest that that's not necessary. The plaintiff's case required them, if there was going to be a finding on conspiracy, the plaintiff was required to carry the burden of proof of all the elements of the statute, the joint and several statute, and it requires that there be two or more conspirators. The intercorporate conspiracy doctrine simply goes to that aspect of the plaintiff's case. What is a conspirator? What is the legal standing of someone to be a conspirator? The intercorporate conspiracy doctrine obviously says that where you have employees of a corporation acting on behalf of the corporation within their authority, it's only one legal person. And that kicks out the language that's required by the statute. So it's not really, it's a failure, it's sort of like a general denial. It's a failure of the plaintiff to carry the burden the plaintiff has of proving the conspiracy.
Can I follow you up on that, though? What is the claim that the joint and several liability is attaching to? I mean, is that a standalone tort claim in this case? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I'm sorry, I should have said it was a conspiracy, so everybody would have been on notice we could have tried it that way. But it wasn't. The court did find that the prayer clause had joint and several liability.
What was the substantive claim that was actually litigated?
Mr. Reed, I thought it was fraud, yes. Yeah. That's okay. What the trial judge said.
So the substantive claim is that these two officers defrauded the employees of the company.
Okay. But you're suggesting simply that the conspiracy claim was not litigated because it was dismissed early on.
Well, no. What was dismissed was the Wage Claim Act. What ultimately survived was a fraud claim.
Okay.
And it was converted by the trial court. Converted is the wrong word, but the trial court then pulled that up from the prayer clause to joint several liability. That's the issue we have today, is whether joint several liability for the fraud should attach. Mr. Jeffers, as has been mentioned, Mr. Jeffers, the president of the company, who all of the plaintiffs at trial testified, was the only person they got any sort of, during this time frame, got any sort of misrepresentation from concerning the status of the finances of the business. He hasn't appealed. He didn't go to the court of appeals yet. He's not here on cert.
So I guess your argument that you're saying you did not waive the claim because it was their burden to show a conspiracy to satisfy joint and several liability, and that they did not do that.
Exactly.
Is that your position? Okay, thank you.
Could I ask just one follow-up there, too? Did you ever make an issue in the Court of Appeals or object at all that you just simply weren't put on notice that conspiracy was an issue because it only arose in the claim for damages rather than as a separate cause of action?
In fact, if you're testing my memory, but I believe I did, yes. I think that was my counter-argument to their argument that we hadn't raised it before.
Wait a minute. Isn't that a little inconsistent with the argument that the issue is raised merely by the fact that they're asking for joint and several liability?
Well, I mean,
that seems to suggest that you do have notice of it.
Well, I think both apply. I don't know that it necessarily says that I had notice of it. I think both apply in the idea that because it wasn't raised as a claim attached to the substantive claim of fraud, because it wasn't raised as a claim, the focus of the trial at the trial level really wasn't on conspiracy.
Anyway, that's your limited point, is that that's the source of some of the lack of information, which actually is perhaps to your benefit as opposed to the other party, but you're not actually making some claim that there's some action that we should take differently as a result of that. You still focus on basically the fact that this conspiracy is not legally possible, essentially.
Yes.
Okay.
If I understood your question, yes.
Before you move on, I'm sorry, but just following up on the Court of Appeals, so what did you make basically a conspiracy can't conspire with itself, or a corporation can't conspire with itself kind of argument when you appealed before the Court of Appeals? I guess I'm trying to figure out how it was that issue, in your view, interjected by the Court of Appeals, or had you raised it in the Court of Appeals?
I think the true answer is that the Court of Appeals interjected it as a test to whether the joint and several liability claim had been shown, whether that statute had been satisfied. So they interjected. I didn't argue it as such. We argued more the absence of any evidence whatsoever that Mr. Bush had been involved. And Mr. Bush lives in Delaware when he's not traveling to Africa. He works for a charity in Africa.
I'm sorry, I want to ask one question about that point. The Court of Appeals just simply bypassed that argument, right, and basically said we're going to assume that the evidence is sufficient, in so many words, but legally you can't have this kind of a claim.
Well, I hope we haven't bypassed it entirely.
Well, is it true that that at least is the way the Court of Appeals postured its decision?
They said they didn't need to reach it because they thought the doctrine applied.
Obviated the necessity to discuss the facts.
Exactly.
So the only place where we have a finding of fact or any discussion of the facts is in the truck order, which was very clear about finding that there was a conspiracy.
It was clear there was a finding. It's not clear where the judge got the reasoning for the finding. All he said in the trial court's findings of fact and conclusion of law was that because these people were officers together working for the corporation with communications of a frequent nature, that somehow the treasurer out in Delaware or, again, in Africa had to have known what the president was representing to the employees. That's the reason the paucity of evidence is important, because it goes to that must have known finding by the trial judge. And it also suggests that any treasurer giving any indication to a president of any company where the company is failing subjects himself to liability. And if we don't have the doctrine, that's going to be a significant problem in the future for corporate officers.
Could you just repeat that? I didn't quite catch the beginning of it.
The significance of the doctrine as it applies to this case is, and I think any case where you have a treasurer of a failing company, obviously the treasurer of the failing company has a duty to deal with the finances of the company, to talk to the other officers in the company, to the other employees, I'd suggest as well. To people that work for the company as to the finances of the company. If the company's failing, the treasurer is going to know perhaps before anybody else. That doesn't mean he can stop the company from failing.
Mr. Reed?
And it doesn't mean that he is representing to the individual employees that it's otherwise. There's no testimony ever in any part of this record on appeal that Mr. Bush ever talked to any of the employees about the finances of the company, other than once in January in 2002, where he told Mr. Delano directly that it was a paycheck by paycheck proposition. In fact, Mr. Delano testified that's why he quit.
Mr. Bush is an F.
I wish I had that. I wish I was Mr. Bush. He's quite a gentleman.
Okay. Well, the only, what you said to the Chief Justice, I think, is accurate, except that assumes that the officers were acting on a corporate, within their corporate authority. But if you take it out of that, then you don't have a situation which deals with every failing corporation and a treasurer who may or may not know. And the difficulty about this case, at least as far as this doctrine is concerned, is that the judge found that they were outside the scope. I mean, I'm reading outside the scope of their direct authority. I mean, that's a factual finding.
I don't know that he really found that they were outside the scope as such. What he suggested was that they should have known better than to have represented corporate finances at a time when they were no longer in control of the company.
He said that.
In control of the company.
That's true, but he said knew or should have known that assurances available funds for paychecks were outside the scope of the direct authority, and the situation was further aggravated by the continuing assurances by the defendant after they received the opinion of independent consultant. I mean, those are kind of like facts. We as much as we'd like to, we can't rule on those
I'm
facts.
Confused on the facts now, but going on Justice Benner's question there. Was there an assurance by Mr. Bush that the funding was there to pay the wage claims, or do we have, as you, I think you said, solely misrepresentations by Mr. Jeffers? I don't.
There are two timeframes here.
Okay.
Timeframe October to the end of February, October 01 to the end of February 02. That's the only thing that's really up in front of this court. That's the joint and several liability that the Court of Appeals found. During that time frame, both of these gentlemen were officers. Mr. Jeffers, I think, resigned at the end of February 2002. During that period of time, only Mr. Jeffers represented anything to the employees. Jeffers was out here in Colorado. He was here on a day-by-day basis. He ran the shop, so to speak. At no time during that time frame, in fact, at no time during any of the time frame, did any of these employees ever suggest that Mr. Bush, and Mr. Bush testified directly, he had never even been to Colorado during this. The only conversation he had with anybody was one conversation on the phone, the conversation with Mr. Delano, where he said, the financing isn't that great. The payroll is iffy. Payroll by payroll.
Oh, wait a second. I mean, this is the problem, I think. I'm reading it from the order. This culminated in the March 11, 2002 phone conference with Defendant Bush, in which Bush then directly participated in a known misrepresentation to some of the plaintiffs about their pay.
Okay. That's the second time frame.
Yes.
March 1st, post-April.
March 11th.
In March, after Mr. Jeffers had left, so it can't be a conspiracy with Jeffers anymore, he's gone. Mr. Bush, in a telephone conversation, is asked by, apparently, I think four of the five plaintiffs were in a conference call with Mr. Bush, who is still the treasurer. They asked him what he knew about the finances. There was a letter of credit, it wasn't mentioned. There was a $500,000 letter of credit that was being drawn down. When it looked like there wasn't going to be a product, and Mr. Bush told the venture capitalists in Hong Kong that there wasn't were going to be a product timely, they pulled the letter of credit. They just took it off the table. So at that point, there was no more money. Or there was in the process of being no more money. Mr. Bush made his own direct representation according to what the trial court found. We obviously disagreed with that, but according to what the trial court found, he made his own representation that the company had sufficient financing to keep these people employed. But understand, all of the people that we were talking about, only two of them were still employed by the company. By the time the actual letter came around, everyone else had quit.
Oh, but then he talks about February, and he says it's specific. He finds your client made misrepresentations that were direct and intentional and so forth. And he also says that that the plaintiffs testified that the date and circumstances of this meeting were quite specific, and Bush's memory is vague, etc. He had an epiphany of memory.
But I guess if I can go along with all looking at this order pretty closely, he does indicate that Bush, that Jeffers had already abandoned the office in February.
Yeah.
And that, so what you're saying makes some sense, is that Bush was the only person there of the people we're talking about in March.
Bush is winding up in March.
The trouble is that, and I think this is what we're struggling with, is inconsistent with the final sentence in this order, which basically says, you know, there was this tacit agreement to act in concert. It doesn't tell us who or when or exactly how. And so I hate to sort of beat this dead horse of procedure, but the Court of Appeals didn't discuss this at all. They just went immediately to the legal issue. Is your position that this evidence is insufficient to support that?
I certainly would prefer the Court of Appeals to have given us alternative rulings, but they didn't do that.
All right.
With respect to the March representations, again, the only thing anybody testified to in terms of talking, and I briefed this extensively in front of the Court of Appeals, the only thing anybody talked to about Mr. Bush was that March 11th telephone conversation. He didn't talk to anybody about finances, at least any of the plaintiffs, about finances at any point up to that point. And there were only two employees left, that was Parker and Perez. It's significant to note that what the Court of Appeals did is it said we're going to treat that as a direct misrepresentation, not joint and several for somebody else's act, and we're going to hold Mr. Bush liable for that. We haven't appealed that decision. That's not here on cert. He's going to pay that.
So what's the amount of those damages?
Perez and Park were only relied to the extent that they stayed on for another 10 days or 2 weeks.
Okay.
Instead of those 10 days or 2 weeks, it's significantly less than the judgment.
What's the amount of money that then is at issue with regard to this joint and several liability that Mr. Bush would suffer from Mr. Jeffers' actions?
I believe it's about $75,000.
But and that would represent 80%. What everybody else, all the other employees, what does that sum fee?
The first one was about $89,000, and that was all the defendants for all periods, including joint and several, including direct liability. After the Court of Appeals was done, I think we were down to about $10,000, maybe $11,000 or $12,000, and that's just for the liability to Parker and Perez on the March 11th conversation. Direct liability, the taking out the joint and several.
And so if you put the joint and several back in, it would be the $89,000.
All attorney's fees plus interest.
Against the two of them for all of the plaintiffs.
Against two of them, both of them jointly and severally for all the defendants. I might regroup here just a second.
Tariq, can I ask you to switch gears for a second and talk about the statute itself and the analogy to the civil rights statute? What's your position on Mr. Will's
argument? The civil rights statute talks about, expressly mentions individuals acting in concert. What that court and what the federal courts have decided with respect to the civil rights statute, as I understand it, is that language is somewhat broader than the language that's in our state statute. The state statute talks about two or more persons, and that leaves us to decide what a person is under the statute. That's where the doctrine comes to play, is what is that quote unquote person. Officers of a corporation generally are held not to be able to conspire with their own corporation, not with each other while they're acting on behalf of the corporation. I don't think the purpose of the civil rights statute is different. And under the civil rights statute, if individuals conspire, individuals, not legal persons, but any individuals, combine somehow and act in concert to take away someone's civil rights, that purpose would be somehow defeated if you apply the doctrine to that statute. So I think that's why the civil rights statute is broader in effect, does not allow for the doctrine to be applied. Does that make sense to everybody? Good. Now, if we ever apply the doctrine, what happens? Well, then the argument is that somehow certain people get to, as counsel has said, people working on behalf of the company get to cheat people, other people. That's not what I'm suggesting the court should adopt. Hart versus King, the Connecticut case that plays so big a part in the doctrine, has direct language on that at page 971. The intercorporate conspiracy doctrine, if applied too broadly, could immunize all private conspiracies from redress where the actors coincidentally were opposed to the same company. Aware of this possibility, courts have created a scope of employment exception that recognizes a distinction between collaborative acts done in pursuit of an employer's business and private acts done by persons who happen to work at the same place. I would add to that corporate acts that are by people at the same place for their own personal benefit. And the personal benefit question, I think, is a valid question. There's no personal benefit here. There's no final case that makes, at any point in this process, that makes the officers individually liable for on wage claim act. And certainly, by the time the case came to issue, that's completely gone.
Mr. Reed, I want to go back to that statute, because the civil rights statute uses the word two or more persons conspire, which is exactly the kind of language. I mean, I think that you're maybe right in a different way, but it says about being broader.
Well, I think it is broader. I apologize if I've misquoted the statute. I don't have it right in front of me. But my understanding of the reasoning was that individuals can deprive someone of a civil right whether they're acting inside the company for corporate purposes or not, and they wouldn't apply the doctrine. And that's why, because the purpose is to protect people's civil rights. But the doctrine has its own limits. it protects against people acting to cheat others. There has to be a valid corporate purpose. The Pittman case, the Pittman versus Larson, in my brief, talks about personal motivation. In that case, an employer, he owns the company, he's also the president of the company, he fires the salesman because the salesman at 17% commissions is making more money than the president every year. The president doesn't like that. He tries to cut the commissions. They get into an argument. He ultimately discharges the employee, then takes his customers and distributes them amongst a bunch of other people at the same percentage rate, the same commission rate. So the company doesn't benefit one way at all, or another at all. There's a suit for a conspiracy to interfere with contract. And the clerk there in Pittman says that without talking about the doctrine by name, says that there's no valid company purpose to do such a thing, that it has to be the ego of the president that's really being satisfied. That's a personal benefit to the president. In our case, I think the question is appropriate. What is the personal benefit? And there really wasn't any personal benefit mentioned by anybody in this case, certainly not by the trial judge in his findings.
I think I've been having trouble all along with what the personal benefit is. And I mean, is the personal benefit, as viewed from the plaintiff's point of view, keeping the company, not your point of view, but the plaintiff's point of view, keeping the company going so that maybe this product can be completed? Was there any evidence that would suggest that that was even a possibility?
Well, everyone wanted the product to come out, and there's always representations, a few more weeks, a few more weeks, a few more weeks, and it just never happened. And that's why the company went out of business, is it just didn't have a product to sell. It actually had a customer in South Africa that my client had been involved in getting on board, couldn't provide a product. And once they brought out an independent engineer to take a look at what the company had, and it didn't have anything and wasn't close, my client then told the venture capitalist that was the case, that it wasn't close, and the venture capitalist closed the business down.
What was the date when that happened?
It wasn't actually completely closed down until the end of March, beginning of April of 2002.
Okay.
And my client sent a list of all the debts, including the wages here, to Mr. Chan, the venture capitalist in Hong Kong. And it was Chan's decision who to pay and not pay. It wasn't my client's decision who to pay and not pay. So the idea that somehow my client only paid things he was personally liable, might be personally liable on, doesn't apply at all. It was the venture capitalist who paid those who were paid.
Just one more clarification. So if the company finally closed down at the end of March or early April, the phone conversation that your client's willing to take personal responsibility for took place on March 11th.
March 11th.
But you think that he should not take personal responsibility for anything before that or anything after that?
What I'm saying is he had no direct involvement or participation in anything before that.
It would have to have been before that,
because
Mr. Jeffers was out of there by the end of February, right?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
When reviewing the cases across the country where the doctrine has been applied, I just want to give the court sort of a sense of the types of cases. There have been creditors versus debtors, former employees versus the employers and the employers' managers in the business, debtors versus creditors, almost everybody against city and county. The doctrine has been extended to the city and county governments across the country, city employees acting on behalf of their political corporate employer have been immunized because of this, against conspiracy doctrines. So it's important to maintain that, and I think for the court to keep in mind, that this is a very broadcast immunization that, if we do away with, is going to affect a lot of people, both in the private economy and in political corporations. Prosser and Keaton probably is where I'll finish, and that is the Prosser quote that talks about mere knowledge by any party small thing sufficient to be considered a concerted effort. At most, this record reflects that my client may have known of misrepresentations. And I say at most because I can't find it anywhere in the record itself. The trial court does say that he believes it's clear the court's making an extrapolation. He believes that the trial judge believed that, how did he put it, something to the effect that it would be highly improbable if they didn't know. But that's not the same thing as saying, here's the evidence I'm relying on. So, because we have such a broadcast possibility if the doctrine's taken away, and because these are easy complaints to make but hard to prove, the long and the short of it is that we are going to find ourselves suing people from wanting to be officers of corporations in this state. 32 states have adopted this, according to the ALR site. 32 states have adopted this doctrine out of about, I think it's maybe 35 that have considered it.
What do we do with the trial court's findings that the conduct was willful and wanton?
Well, I think that was made fine on March 11th. Again, we disagree with that finding.
But well, I understand you disagree with it, but doesn't that take it out of the usual corporate case you're talking about?
Only March 11th. My client stands by his...
Well, no, but the trial court's findings are not that... I don't think they're...
Well, they find us willful and wanton with respect to the overall...
Everything.
Several.
Yes. And isn't that a restraint on... you were talking about making corporate officers afraid to take positions and so on.
Well, I
should be afraid to take willful and wanton, act willful and wantonly.
My response to that, I think, is that A, there's no evidence of it, and B, but see, there are some cases you can talk about willful and wanton. You're dealing with a corporation. Outside people are dealing with a corporation. They're looking to the corporation for their satisfaction for whatever's happening. Corporate immunization of officers is meant to do just that, immunize them so that they can make decisions. If every decision is going to be second-guessed, then you've got a problem chilling the corporate officers.
So let me try one more time. How does that apply to willful and wanton conduct, that your theory?
I suggest a close reading of the order says that it's willful and wanton as to the conspiracy. So the acts of the conspirators are willful and wanton, and it's he puts everybody in one big bag.
Okay.
Thank you. Oh, there is one other thing I wanted to point out in the complaint. A lot of these cases made a point that the plaintiff's complaints directly alleged that officers were acting on behalf of the corporation at all times. That's our complaint in this case. The plaintiffs themselves alleged that this is behavior on behalf of the corporation in the complaint, and that was, despite several amendments, never changed. Thank you. Can you see?
Just a couple of things during that discussion that I'd like to address and perhaps do a little bit of a job earlier as well. There is this issue in this case where the court does not only apply to the First Immunity Doctrine, but then says that there just isn't any evidence in the record to support the plaintiff's contention that the misrepresentations that were made in this case were outside the scope of these of the authority of these individuals. And I believe this all ties together to a certain extent the questions from Justice Malarkey just now. We are talking about a fraud here. We're not talking about a breach of contract. We're not talking about ministerial acts. We're talking about fraud and misrepresentation. This is a different consideration than if we were talking about those kinds of cases. Counsel has referred to those cases. We have distinguished those cases in an appendix to our brief and believe that that is a different circumstance. But in this particular case, there is a fraud. That is the basis of the claim. The derivative of that is the conspiracy claim, and I believe that's the way that Colorado recognizes a conspiracy claim in fact, the statute, is that there has to be an underlying claim for which that statute then attaches, and that was done. I would like to refer again to the court's own trial court's own order and remind this court that specifically the trial court found that after this point in time, where this restructuring had to take place in October of 1991, and the financial arrangements were made, the court found at this point in time the defendants knew or should have known that assurances of available funds for paychecks were outside the scope of their direct authority. And that's what we're talking about here, is their direct authority.
May I interrupt one second? We've talked about the burden with regard to proving whether somebody's acting outside the scope of their authority, and the trial court's made findings. I thought there was a suggestion, and I think there certainly was in the authorities cited, that this was a matter of fact, presumably meaning that if there's any evidence whatsoever, we wouldn't touch a trial court finding. But I just wanted to ask you, is there a difference between the historical findings of fact about what these defendants did and a determination what precisely is the scope of their authority?
Well, I think, interestingly enough, Your Honor, at the trial court, and again, if you'll look at the specific references to the statements that were made by Mr. Bush in the trial, you're gonna see in there that there is this close connection, day-to-day operation, knowledge, etc., between he and Mr. Jeffers, who's here. And then on top of that, he also admits that after this restructuring took place, he was only staying on because he was asked by the venture capitalists to do that until they could get someone to replace him, and that his actions were only ministerial at that time, and that he was doing nothing but signing checks. And it is that testimony, I believe, that the trial court found, in addition to the restructuring, that made it completely unreasonable for him to believe that he would have the authority to be making representations about how much money there was to pay these employees. But
apparently the Court of Appeals, if I can just follow up real quickly here, I took it what the Court of Appeals was saying, though, not disputing what he thought or what he did, but rather disputing what his authority was. And I thought, in effect, the Court of Appeals was saying the trial court was wrong in finding that this restructuring had now placed this outside of his authority. And as a matter of law, it was within his authority.
I think there were two things going on there in that Court of Appeals opinion. One was that they were really looking at sort of an apparent, looking this as an apparent authority sort of thing, where because if you look at their language, it's specific about their position as officers in the corporation, and that as officers of the corporation, they may have the right to do certain things. They also, the Court of Appeals also said that there was no evidence in the record to support that finding. And we dispute both of those. First, with respect to this idea of apparent authority, what we're talking about really is actual authority. And that's where we've cited the restatement third about whether it is a reasonable belief for that individual to believe that they have that authority. And the Cooley case as well speaks to this idea. We're talking about the actual authority.
I think we have to draw this to an end.
Okay. We're talking about the actual authorities. I'm sorry, Your Honor. I did not notice
that. Just finish your sentence.
Okay. The actual authority as opposed to apparent authority, and I believe that that's where the Court of Appeals got off track. Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you all.
On behalf of the court, I want to thank both counsel for your arguments. Case stands submitted. The court.